Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine welcomes Dr. Michael Girardi. Dr. Girardi is an associate professor of dermatology and associate clinical director of the Immunology and Immunotherapy Research Program at Yale Cancer Center. Here's Francine Foss.
Mike, we're here today to talk about non-melanotic skin cancers. So overall, there are two different types of skin cancer, melanoma and non-melanotic. So what are all these non-melanotic skin cancers?
So non-melanoma skin cancer is kind of a catch-all term for all the other skin cancers, among the most common of which are basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma. And these are the most common cancers in the world, and therefore they become a particular problem and concern for patients, particularly at risk. And the timing is quite good to think about these and talk about these as we head into the spring months.
Exactly. And I know that you're going to tell our audience that we all need to start breaking out our sunscreen now.
We do. We certainly need to think about it. The data is indisputable in terms of sun exposure, tanning salon exposure being among the most and biggest risk factors for non-melanoma skin cancer.
So, Mike, I think reiterating on what you just said, that these cancers are the most common cancers. In fact, you know, what is the lifetime risk of, say, the average person in the United States to get one of these types of cancers?
Well, so when we talk about skin cancer in general and we talk about risk and how common they are, it's in the group of melanoma, we talk about over a lifetime of about 1 in 70. And this is actually seems to be increasing.
That sounds like a really high number.
Yes, it's quite high. And when we talk about non-melanoma skin cancer, we're talking about 2 or 3 times greater for non-melanoma skin cancers than melanoma itself.
So can you talk a little bit about, obviously, risk factors? Sun seems to be the biggest risk factor.
Sun exposure. And there's certainly a fair amount of consideration for someone's genetics. And so it's, again, a combination of what type of genes they have that could predispose them. And so we often ask patients about their first-degree relatives, that is, parents or siblings or children, first-degree relatives, and whether there's a family history of skin cancer in these patients. So we'll ask about basal cell carcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, as well as melanoma itself in the family. Patients who have a family history of skin cancer at far greater risk than people who do not. So clearly there are genes that predispose patients to skin cancer and genes that protect people from skin cancer. When we talk about risk factors, we have to look at a patient's skin type, and that is how fair they are. In particular, among the fairest are those with red hair who freckle a lot. These are at the greatest risk of getting non-melanoma skin cancer as well as melanoma itself. We also talk about their lifestyle. What kind of lifestyle do they have that would give them that kind of sun exposure? In particular, in Connecticut, we'll think about tennis players, golfers on one hand. We'll think about farmers and people who spend most of their time at work outside, as also being at great risk for this. So it runs the gamut of all different types of people and their sun exposure. We have to strongly consider the beach lovers, the sun worshipers, and also sailors in particular are another group in Connecticut that are at great risk for a lot of sun exposure over years that will predispose them to skin cancer.
So, Mike, can you talk about sun exposure in general? Is there a risk for younger people who have had sun exposure, say, for 10 or 15 years or so? Or is the risk more for people who have had it over a longer period of time?
The answer is both. And here's how I would break it out. I think photoprotection has to be on the mind of parents, even with their newborn babies. And the data shows that even a single blistering sunburn substantially increases the risk of a person's chance of getting melanoma over that lifetime. So a burn that causes blisters in childhood actually increases that person's risk of melanoma for their entire life. So melanoma seems to be more of a concern for single or multiple episodes of blistering sunburn, so this intense hit even when you're young, whereas non-melanoma skin cancer seems to be more of a concern with regard to chronic sun exposure. So people have been repeatedly exposed to the sun or for tanning salons, for that matter.
When we talk about sun exposure, how long and how much sun?
Well, that varies tremendously. And it varies tremendously because people's susceptibility varies tremendously from the fairness of their skin and, as we talked about, the genetics of their protection. And so, for the most part, you want to completely avoid getting to a point where you're going to get sunburns, in particular, getting a blistering sunburn. And so people need to determine, based on their skin type and on their family history, how much sun exposure that really is. There's actually one particular downside to too little sun exposure, and that you'll hear that an argument for sun exposure for vitamin D levels. And in fact, vitamin D is particularly important for the immune system and functions of the immune system. And so patients who are at risk for skin cancer who are protecting themselves also need to make sure that they're having adequate intake of vitamin D or have their level actually checked by a primary care physician. So to answer your question, it's almost like saying how much smoking is too much, you know, but we can't avoid sun exposure completely because there is a downside to it.
So basically, if you're the type of person who can go out there and not, you know, in an hour or two, not really develop any kind of a sunburn at all, are you okay to go outside without sunscreen?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that you still need to wear sunscreen and minimize your exposure.
Okay.
So the kind of guidelines you want to follow is when you can, you want to avoid most of the midday sun because these are the direct rays most likely to cause damage to the skin cells. And we've kind of expanded that over the years as we've seen the data come in to really being from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So not just, you know, around noon and not just, you know, 1 p.m. So that's quite a window. Now, of course, nobody can avoid sun exposure or being outside all the time on those hours. So when we need to be, then we need to protect our skin. And we can do that with sunblock, which is my preferred term as opposed to suntan lotion or suntan oil. And really, you want an SPF of at least 15. I tell my patients at risk to actually go at least 30 with the SPF. I prefer the physical blockers, which contain zinc oxide or titanium dioxide as the protectors. But people can protect themselves with also by wearing clothing, and they'll actually make tight weave clothing that goes under different brands that are particularly good at blocking the rays of the sun. And so in these ways, we can still enjoy life, we can still get out there and still be protected from most of the damaging rays of the sun.
And when we're going out and just conducting our normal daily activities and we're not specifically sunbathing, say like on your weekend when you do all your errands and you're in and out of the house all the time, do you need to worry about that level of sun exposure? Do we need to wear sunscreen all the time?
So I think this is somewhat debatable. I think that over many years, that little bit of sun exposure every day will take its toll, in particular in patients who are at risk. And so they make some very nice daily moisturizers now that are appropriate for applications to the face, the hands, and the arms that will contain an SPF of 15. And I think that can serve as your daily maintenance and protecting yourself from the sun.
In terms of thinking about these kinds of cancers, you know, we hear a lot about melanoma, but we don't really hear a lot about these non-melanotic skin cancers. Can you talk a little bit about what the different types are?
Sure. The primary reason we don't hear so much about them and the reason melanoma gets most of the hype is that melanoma is the deadliest of the skin cancers. And it's one of the biggest causes of deaths in young people. So it does get its deserved share of concern in that regard. But non-melanoma skin cancers are, as I said earlier, more common and fortunately not as deadly as melanoma. The most common type is basal cell carcinoma. And basal cell carcinoma arises predominantly in sun-exposed areas. It can be quite benign looking at first, more like a pink little bump. Sometimes it has a translucent or pearly quality to it. Other times it's very fragile, so the slightest little rub, the slightest little scratch will lead to an area of bleeding or a scab that seems to not heal. And whenever a patient sees this kind of change, they need to bring it to the attention of their primary care physician and hopefully to a dermatologist who can do a shave biopsy, a very, very simple procedure to have it examined for basal cell carcinoma. Basal cell carcinoma is not the type of skin cancer that can really travel in the body. And so if you're going to get a cancer, that's the one to get. But on the other hand, it can be quite invasive. It can go deep into the skin. And that could be a particular concern when it occurs in anatomical areas where surgery can become a problem, such as on the face, near an eye, near a nose or a lip. And so so it still has its concerns for treatment, and we want to catch them early so that we can minimize the surgery. The other major type of non-melanoma skin cancer is squamous cell carcinoma. And squamous cell carcinoma often looks very different than basal cell carcinoma. It often arises as a hard little bump, as opposed to basal carcinoma, which is usually soft. And this hard little bump can become painful, and that's a sign that it's actually become invasive. And so, because squamous cell carcinoma, unlike basal cell carcinoma, does have a small chance of traveling in the body, of metastasizing, in particular if it's in certain areas such as on the lip, on the ear, and other areas on the face, we also want to catch that early and get rid of that early through surgery.
Mike, there are a lot of folks out there who have these small tumors like these basal cell cancers and don't even know about them.
Yes, because they can often look fairly benign early, patients will often ignore them, and this can become a problem. Now, a lot of the times a basal cell carcinoma can sit there for years and grow very slowly. Most of them do, but other times they can grow fairly rapidly and become invasive. So bring it to the attention, get it dealt with, and then the patient can move on from there.
Okay, a strong message for everybody out there who's a sun worshiper. We're going to take a short break now for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about non-melanotic skin cancer with Dr. Michael Girardi.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2010, over 2,000 people will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer in Connecticut alone, and nearly 150,000 in the U.S. Early detection is the key, and when detected early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. Men and women over the age of 50 should have regular colonoscopies to screen for the disease. Patients with colorectal cancer have more hope than ever before. Each day, more patients are surviving the disease due to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. New options include a Chinese herbal medicine being used in combination with chemotherapy to reduce side effects of treatment and help cancer drugs work more effectively. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my guest, Dr. Michael Girardi, Associate Professor of Dermatology and Associate Clinical Director of the Immunology and Immunotherapy Research Program at the Yale Cancer Center. We're here today discussing non-melanotic skin cancers. So, Mike, we talked before the break about the fact that there are a lot of folks out there who probably have these non-melanotic skin cancers and don't even realize it yet. So if somebody has a suspicious lesion, something that they're worried about, what would they do next?
Well, I think they would bring it to the attention of their primary care physicians, and my bias is that they should insist that it be seen by a dermatologist, a specialist in the care of patients' skin, so that it can be appropriately examined and a determination made as to whether it would be appropriate to do a biopsy on the lesion. And people hear the word biopsy, and I think there's hesitation there, but really a skin biopsy is a very simple procedure. The skin is easily accessible. Often just a small piece, a very, very tiny 2 or 3 millimeter piece of the area in question needs to be sampled and does not need to be sampled deep. And so the skin biopsy is the definitive way to determine whether a particular lesion on the skin is a skin cancer or not. And this is done by a dermatologist, and it's quite simple, a procedure.
And Mike, I can say that I've actually been in your office, and you've done that procedure on me. And just to let the audience know, I had no idea that Dr. Girardi did the procedure. We were talking, and then he said, "We're done." And so clearly it is a painless procedure. In addition, you mentioned the issue of shaving. When do you do a biopsy? When do you do a shave?
So a shave is actually a type of biopsy. It's probably the simplest type of biopsy. It's done with a razor that basically takes a sliver of the skin off. We also do another type of biopsy called a punch, and that's the more common one that'll give us a little more information about the deeper area. And so we have to determine whether most of what we're looking at is in the superficial part of the skin or whether there could be a component that's deeper. For a melanoma, we'll often, if we're ruling that out, we'll often do a punch to make sure that no part of it's gone deep. And squamous cell carcinoma will sometimes do a punch to examine the deeper portion.
We also hear about the use of liquid nitrogen to burn these tumors off. When do you actually do that?
Well, liquid nitrogen is a dermatologist and a sun damaged patient's best friend in several ways. It's most commonly used to freeze off the precancerous lesions that can precede squamous cell carcinoma, and these are called actinic keratoses. And these arise, again, in sun-damaged areas as kind of gritty little bumps that you can sometimes feel better than you can see. And not all of these will go on to squamous cell carcinoma. Somewhere in the range of 1 in 50 to 1 in 100 will actually go on. But this is the easiest way to nip it in the bud, and that is to freeze it with liquid nitrogen. And we use a spray canister that keeps it under a high pressure and produces a very, very tight, fine spray with precision to be able to destroy one by one these actinic precancerous keratoses.
And this is also something that most people wouldn't even know that they had unless they came to see a dermatologist.
Yes, I think that there's some education that needs to go on from the primary care physician or dermatologist as to what to look for with actinic keratoses, because again, if we can freeze these off early or treat them with a cream, which is another way we can treat these sun-damaged areas with a fair number of actinic keratoses, then we can do a lot to prevent future surgeries, future development of basal cell and squamous cell carcinoma, and protection, therefore, against the slight chance that one of these squamous cell carcinomas could travel in the body.
So, Mike, going back to the whole issue of who should be screened, can you talk a little bit about what population of patients, again, need to get in for preventive screening?
So anyone with lesions in question need to be screened, whether, you know, they've seen a new lesion that there's some concern about in terms of some of the signs and symptoms I talked about earlier. But if our primary care physician sees a lesion in question, they'll refer it to a dermatologist so that the patient can be examined with a full body skin examination to look for that. Patients who are at genetic risk with a family history, again, if there's a family history of melanoma in a primary relative, that patient really needs a full body skin examination by a dermatologist on a yearly basis.
Starting at what age?
At any age. So children, even with a parent with a history of melanoma, need to be screened. In particular, if they have a large number of nevi or moles.
So, Mike, once the diagnosis is made, and you mentioned that it's made by biopsying these skin lesions, what happens after that?
So then a treatment plan needs to be put in place, an appropriate treatment plan. If it's on the what we call the truncal or extremity skin, that is the back, the abdomen, the chest, or the arms or legs, then these can usually be treated by simple excision within the office of a dermatologist, or by destruction, which is the most common form being electrodesiccation and curettage, which means an electrical destruction as well as a scraping by curettage. If there's any concern about adjacent areas, such as we see with skin cancers on the face, then often the patient is sent for a special procedure called Mohs, that's M-O-H-S, micrographic surgery. And that's done by a specialist who will take the patient. They'll do a very tight excision without a lot of normal skin being taken off, and they will examine that tissue right there in the office while the patient waits to see if the lesion is completely removed. Any positive margins at that time will be dealt with at that same time, so the patient will be brought back into the room and a little bit more of skin at that one edge that might still have some skin cancer left will be subsequently removed in another stage. And therefore, this procedure will minimize the amount of normal tissue that needs to be taken out and also ensure that the lesion is completely excised. So it has a dual purpose in that regard. And so it has become a major benefit to patients with skin cancer, particularly on the face.
And again, only certain patients require that kind of a procedure.
Correct. And so that determination is made by the dermatologist as well as the Mohs surgeon, who will see the patient first in what we call a Mohs consultation.
Mike, can you talk about how frequently these tumors recur after they're excised?
Well, that depends on a lot of factors. That depends on how it was treated, what the anatomical location was, and what the primary skin cancer type was. For melanoma, we often take a fairly wide excision, meaning a 1 centimeter rim of normal tissue. For basal cell and squamous cell carcinoma, we will often do that also, except when we're near anatomical locations where we have to try to minimize the removal of the normal tissue, and then we go to Mohs surgery. In general, for lesions treated in the office by simple excision or electrodesiccation and curettage, we see a 95% cure rate. Now, that means that over the years, we might see a recurrence, but that can easily be treated itself.
Mike, do these patients ever require CT scans or PET scans or other imaging studies?
That's rare. Certainly, basal cell carcinoma, there's not any real concern for metastasis there. Squamous cell carcinoma, in particular areas, could be a concern. And as I said earlier, on the lips, on the ears, we see a small percentage of patients who can actually develop spread to lymph nodes with squamous cell carcinoma. Whenever there's an enlarged lymph node in these types of patients, then it's appropriate to do some of this screening with a CAT scan or a PET CT scan to ensure that it hasn't traveled in the body.
Mike, is there any role for radiation therapy in patients with these invasive squamous tumors?
Actually, yes. Radiation therapy has been a big help for patients where you can't completely excise some of these lesions because they've gone too deep, or where a patient really can't tolerate surgery for one reason or another. And radiation treatments can be done in a therapeutic radiology center, such as at the Yale Cancer Center, and really be a help to these kind of patients.
So, Mike, we talk a lot about multidisciplinary approaches to cancer, and you mentioned, you know, the Mohs surgery and the use of radiation therapy. Is there a multidisciplinary center here at the Yale Cancer Center to address these invasive skin cancers?
Yes, so as we talked about the role for the therapeutic radiologist, we talked about a role for the Mohs surgeon, the dermatologist. We also have to talk about the role for the oncologist. When these cancers get out of the box, when they metastasize to a lymph node or to elsewhere in the body, the oncologist is really the person who's going to be driving the boat as to what therapy is going to minimize the amount of damage to the patient. And this can be in the form of chemotherapy, but also some of the newer agents that are more selective targets of these types of cancers.
So can you elaborate on what some of those new treatments might be? The EGF receptor, for instance, we hear about that with squamous tumors. Is that appropriate for head and neck cancer? For skin cancer, I'm sorry, we talked about it with respect to head and neck cancer. Perhaps it could be.
Yes. So, as I was mentioning, these are some of the newer targeting agents that will actually target some of the receptors that are positive on the cancers, and the EGF receptor, for example, is positive on some of the squamous cell carcinomas that can metastasize, and so this can be a very helpful treatment that's really come to the forefront over the last couple of years. For these patients who develop metastatic squamous cell carcinoma.
And Mike, I know that you've done a lot of research in your lab looking at the effect of the immune system on the development of cancer. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing?
Sure. So my laboratory at Yale really focuses on some of the earliest events in skin cancer. And that starts from what happens to damaged cells. How are they handled by immune cells within the skin and immune cells that can come to the skin from the blood. And so we look at the various types of immune cells using genetically modified animal models to see how they handle their response to damaged skin cells, how they eliminate them, and in some cases how they actually facilitate their growth. And so there's a double-edged sword to the role of the immune system in skin cancer, and that's a major focus of where we try to look at potential targets for prevention and for treatment.
So, Mike, in the future, hopefully you'll be developing some immunotherapy approaches for these patients with skin cancer.
I'll keep trying.
Excellent. Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure to have you here tonight to talk to us about non-melanotic skin cancer. This has been a terrific show, and I think all of us are going to leave this show knowing that we need to use our sunscreen. Until next week, this is Dr. Francine Foss from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.